this week on the Best of Flashpoints. In the West Bank, a 10-year-old Palestinian child and a teenager are shot dead by Israeli soldiers. The oil barons continue to fleece the American people for billions of dollars in subsidies, while jacking up gas prices and boasting of record profits. One of the leading investigators into voter fraud in Ohio warns of another stolen election coming up this November. And the Block Report features an interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal by San Francisco Bayview journalist Apollonia Jordan. Nora Barrows-Friedman, Dennis Bernstein, and Apollonia Jordan are all coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our drumbeat coverage of the ongoing ethnic cleansing by Israeli occupation forces in the West Bank, specifically in the village of Na'alin. As we reported yesterday, Israeli forces shot and killed a 10-year-old boy, Ahmed Musa, in the head with live ammunition fired from an M16 on Tuesday evening. Around the time of the funeral procession for Ahmed Musa last night, Israeli occupation forces returned to the village and opened fire on villagers, shooting another young Palestinian teenager in the head. 18-year-old Yusuf Ahmed Amira went into a coma after he was shot twice in the head, according to Palestinian news agencies and eyewitnesses. The mayor of Na'alin village said that at least six other young men were also shot and injured by rubber-coated steel bullets after clashes broke out between Israeli occupation soldiers and villagers defending their land. U.S.-made Israeli bulldozers reportedly destroyed barricades built by the villagers at the entrance to Na'alin as Israeli forces began firing tear gas and sound grenades, followed by indiscriminately opening fire. Joining us to talk about the current situation in Na'alin is Hindi Mesleh. Mesleh is an international media organizer from Na'alin village and just returned from the local hospital where 18-year-old Yusuf Ahmed Amira went into a coma and died. Hindi, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
First off, can you talk about the scene at the hospital? You just returned from seeing the body of Yusuf Amira. What did it look like at the hospital? What did Yusuf look like after being shot twice in the head by Israeli forces?
I could not recognize Yusuf. I knew Yusuf for the last few years because I'm from the village. And I met Yusuf quite often, maybe once a week. Today, when I saw him in the hospital, I could not recognize him. He looks different. Two bullets in his head has exploded his head. His face is bigger because of, you know, because he's in coma and his brain is totally dead. I just asked his doctor today about Yusuf. He said that within a few hours he will pass away because his blood pressure went from yesterday was 70, today went to 45, and then it became 50, but it will go down again. Ahmed is it's a matter of hours and Ahmed will pass away again. Yusuf will pass away again.
And Hindi, yesterday on the show, we had an activist describe pretty much the same scene. He was at the hospital and described what it looked like after the 10-year-old boy, Ahmed Musa, was shot and killed on Tuesday evening, the back of his head completely blown away. What's your response to the Israeli occupation military killing two young boys in 2 days?
Actually, I saw both of them. I saw as well Ahmed. It's horrible the way that he was killed. Half of his head was broken into two parts. The response was even the response came from the army after, even during the funeral of Ahmed, the army went in the village and shot tear gas and live and rubber coated steel bullets at the funeral. Then the army closed the entrance of the village. Automatically, the guys will go and with very simple tools will be like throwing stones and protesting in a peaceful and nonviolent resistance. And the army will respond its usual way, rubber-coated steel bullets, gas grenades, and even live ammunition.
That's the voice of Hindi Mesleh. He's an international media organizer from Na'alin village in the occupied West Bank. Hindi, these kinds of lethal and illegal attacks on behalf of the U.S.-supported Israeli occupation military are designed to destroy the will of the protesters, especially Na'alin. Are the people of Na'aleen going to give up their resistance? Are they going to just let the Israeli occupation military and the Israeli government steal your land and construct the illegal apartheid wall? How does this affect the nonviolent protests in Na'aleen?
Israel doesn't want Na'aleen to be a sample, doesn't want this nonviolent and peaceful struggle to spread all over the West Bank, because they know how much this will affect them. I will tell you that the village will never give up, because there is nothing else they can do. They can't leave their place. It's the place that they have been all their lives, them, their grandfathers, their whole families. There is nowhere that we will leave to. It's our place. Today I just met one of the guys, and he was saying, who's next? Because, you know, it's their right. They're going to stay there.
And finally, if you had 5 minutes with Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister, who is ultimately responsible for the military's actions in Na'aleen, killing 2 Palestinian boys in 2 days, but also across the West Bank, in Gaza, and in East Jerusalem, and if you had five minutes as well with the current U.S. presidential candidates who continue to support Israel's actions in every speech related to the Middle East, what would you say about your life, the life of your community in Na'aleen, and especially the life of these boys who were killed in the last 48 hours?
Today I said, for everyone that doesn't know what's going on, I know that Ehud Barak and the U.S. supporters for Israel knows what's going around. But for those who doesn't know what's happening in Na'aleen, imagine yourself in your city and someone is kicking you or putting a huge wall and fence, taking your land and putting you in jail. What you will do, how your life, like, I just want everyone to imagine his life, how it will be if he will be jailed in his house or in his neighborhood, not being allowed to go out. And when he will go out, he will just be, he will go out from one gate that will be controlled by an Israeli soldiers. A miserable life. You know, I just want everyone to imagine those kids that they have been killed are their kids. 18 years has, like, these families has spent days and nights to spend these kids, to raise these kids. And at some point, for 1 second, an Israeli soldier would shoot him in the head, dead. So everyone should imagine his kids being killed by an Israeli soldier. Why? Because they're defending their land, because they're protesting. They're saying no for stealing our land and no for stealing our rights.
Okay, well, we're going to keep watching the story very closely here on Flashpoints. That's the voice of Hindi Mesleh. He's the international media organizer from Na'aleen village inside the occupied West Bank, where once again the Israeli occupation military has come in, opened fire, and 2 young Palestinian boys have been killed in the last 48 hours. Hindi, thank you so much. Please stay safe, and we'll come back to you very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
How low are you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Punchline after punchline, leaving us sore, leaving us sore. Absorbed in your hustle, we
listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we turn our attention to the oil companies. It's being reported that ExxonMobil Corporation made a spectacular second quarter earnings of $11.6 billion. These profits are not being reinvested into things that would end oil addiction, of course, nor is the major oil company paying American taxpayers for the use of their land. A bureaucratic oversight, we now learn, has allowed some 24 oil companies to skip out on more than $1.3 billion in royalties. Joining us to talk about the latest oil company excesses, including ExxonMobil, is Tyson Slocum. Slocum is the Director of Public Citizens Energy Program. And I should say before we go on with Tyson that tomorrow we will actually have Ralph Nader on this show, and he'll be talking about some other issues regarding migrant immigrant rights and what's happening at the border. So Ralph Nader will spend a few minutes with us as a part of our Friday show in which we focus on the region. Tyson Slocum, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hey, great to be here, Dennis.
Good to have you with us, and let's begin by $1.6 billion earnings. That's not bad.
Well, it's actually 11 point.
I'm sorry, 11.6. I'm thinking of the ripoff.
It gets confusing when you got so many zeros.
Let's start with the $11.6 billion. That was their second quarter earning. They added it up right, I'm sure.
Yeah. For the first 6 months of the year, we're looking at $22.6 billion. And on top of that, they spent $16 billion buying back their stock, okay? So that gives you an idea. And they've got almost $40 billion in cash that they haven't even figured out how to spend yet. So this gives you an idea just how much cash oil companies like ExxonMobil are rolling in, and they are not getting the job done in terms of delivering investments in alternatives to our addiction to oil. And that's the great travesty here, Dennis, is that the high prices we're paying at the pump are just going straight into the pockets of big oil companies and to national oil companies overseas, and it's not being reinvested in things that are going to help American families get through this crunch. And that's why Public Citizen has been advocating for years now to repeal all of these billions of dollars of subsidies that oil companies get and instead invest that money into things that American families can get their hands on, like grants to install solar panels on their roof or buy a super fuel-efficient hybrid car or more money to local governments to expand mass transit. Those types of things.
Well, I guess that helps us understand why it's really important for oil companies to raise the prices so that we pay more money at the pumps, right? That explains it.
Yeah. And you know, to add insult to injury, not only are they making these huge profits and we're all paying high prices, but on land that's owned by we the people, federal land, a lot of oil companies are paying little to no royalties for the privilege of extracting valuable gas and oil from our land into their pockets.
Well, tell us about this loophole that some 24 companies managed to skip out, I guess you're saying, on about $1.3 billion in royalties.
And that is just the tip of the iceberg, because it's over 1,000 leases where this bureaucratic mix-up in 1998 and 1999 allowed oil companies that signed lease agreements to not have to pay any royalties. Usually when we sign those kinds of agreements, we put a little escape clause in there. We say, well, you're going to be forced to pay royalties if the price of oil, say, goes to $40 a barrel. At the time that these agreements were signed, oil was around $15, $18 a barrel. So now, as a result, after a decade or so of investment, these companies are now starting to pull oil and natural gas out of federal land in the Gulf of Mexico, and they're not paying a dime for it. And they've already skipped out on $1.3 billion in royalties that should have been paid to the American people, and that is going to turn into more than $60 billion over the 20 to 30 year lifespan of these leases. So this is real money we're talking about, money that should be forming the bedrock of our investments in clean, renewable energy and energy efficiency, and instead it's going into the hands of these oil companies. They sure as heck aren't going to spend it on solar or wind.
Well, yeah, let me forgive my metaphor here, but what involvement is there in the oil companies with all this money? You said they bought back stock, $17 billion, whatever. What are they doing to protect the ozone layer and face their responsibility for the future?
Nothing. And the thing is, Americans are doing our part. Americans drove 30 billion miles less this year compared to last year. So we are responding to the high prices by cutting back, by conserving, because we have to do it, because our family budgets are forcing us to cut back on a lot of things that we used to do. And that's a good thing, but it's coming at great financial hardship to a lot of families. And that's why we've got to reform the system. And what the oil companies are lobbying on is not to provide that kind of assistance to American families, but instead to fight any efforts to repeal tax breaks that unfairly enrich oil companies. They have aggressively fought any efforts to fix this royalty mess. And they're even now working with Senator McCain and Newt Gingrich and President Bush to try to open up more sensitive environmental areas to new drilling. And so that's the oil company's agenda. It's been the Bush agenda for years. And Americans, I think, are ready for a change this November, where we no longer just give the country's keys over to oil companies and let them have at it. We've got to have an energy policy that prioritizes families and not big profitable oil companies.
Well, I'm taking a close look at that, and we do, Tyson Slocum, have a Democratic Congress, but I'm wondering what kind of royalties the Congress gets from the oil companies so they don't have to pay the real royalties.
Right. I mean, definitely when you've got a system of elections like we do in this country that are financed by private entities, politicians engage every day in legalized bribery. I mean, look, we've got a senator from Alaska, Ted Stevens, who's just indicted on 7 criminal counts for accepting bribes from an oil company up there. I mean, Alaska, as we're learning from this criminal investigation, looks more like a banana republic, where lawmakers proudly called themselves members of a corrupt club because they were all on the take from oil companies. So we've got to have reform in the way elections are financed, and that's why my organization, Public Citizen, is at the forefront of supporting publicly financed campaigns so we get corporate money out of the system and have a more accountable democracy like our founding fathers intended.
Who are the top 5 recipients of oil money?
Kay Bailey Hutchison from Texas, John Cornyn from Texas are going to be the top ones. The oil company in general directs about 3/4 of its money to Republicans. So it's a pretty partisan industry. In the Senate, for example, there's only one Democrat who consistently votes with Republicans and with the oil companies, and that's Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat from Louisiana. Other than that, I know the California senators, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, have been fantastic on this issue. They've consistently voted and worked hard to hold big oil accountable. They've also supported efforts to crack down on speculators. So California is lucky to have 2 senators, even though oil is a huge economic interest in the state of California. The senators have consistently sided with the people.
Tyson, you alluded to this notion of buying back stock. I think you said the figure was $17 billion. Why would that be of concern, and why would the ExxonMobil want to buy back their own stock?
Well, companies buy back their own stock to increase the value of the stock in the short term. When you buy up stock, you are, in effect, making it scarce. And when you create scarcity in something, you make it more valuable. And so spending $16 billion, as they have over the last 6 months, and in total they've spent $95.6 billion over the last 3 years buying back stock. That is an astronomical number. And so it enriches people who own the stock. But for public citizens' point of view, it is a massive misallocation of capital. I mean, since 2005, Exxon has spent over $95 billion just buying back stock. Could you imagine if since 2005, instead, Exxon had spent $95 billion providing rebates to families to install solar panels on their roof, to purchase plug-in hybrid vehicles, to make energy-efficient improvements to their home? Those are the types of investments that will bring the United States to energy independence. But instead, we've got a system of our energy policy where big oil companies call the shots. They get rich off of our oil addiction, and they are actively fighting efforts for us to increase our reliance on renewables. The oil companies colluded for years with Detroit automakers to fight improvements in fuel economy standards. Enough is enough. We are getting closer than we ever have before. I've been working on this stuff for a decade in Washington, D.C., Dennis, and we are getting awfully close to finally holding big oil accountable. We've got a minority of senators in the Senate that keep blocking things, and President Bush, of course, issues stern veto threats every time we talk about subsidy reform or holding big oil accountable. But Bush's days are numbered, and I think that a President Obama and even a President McCain would be far more progressive than what we've endured under George Bush.
Well, we're going to obviously get a chance to see that, because probably one of those two will be elected. And I guess what I want to ask you, Tyson, is if one of those two really wanted to make a change, what would we see them do? What could they do swiftly? And is there any indication in their policies to date that they might really do something to restrain them?
Absolutely. The first thing that they could do, and what I've seen in Obama's platform and in his voting record, is subsidy reform, ending all subsidies to big oil companies. Public Citizen estimates that oil companies receive about $9 billion every year in tax breaks and royalty relief and other subsidies. If we were to transfer that $9 billion into a big energy efficiency and renewable energy fund that was available to families, those things would go a long way. Also, both Senators Obama and McCain have been on record as supporting efforts to curtail speculation in the oil markets. It's clear that while supply and demand obviously plays a role in contributing to higher prices, that Wall Street speculators have been adding insult to injury by engaging in possibly illegal manipulation. Tightening the rules, introducing some more transparency in those markets would help bring prices down. But the bottom line is, we've got to start making these real fundamental investments in alternative clean energy today.
We have about 2 minutes left, and I guess I'd like you to talk about this. And it is very serious, the impact that these rising prices for oil and fuels are going to have, and the way in which this is going to reverberate for working people and people who have jobs, two jobs, three jobs, and live on the edge. We're going to see a great deal of suffering around this, aren't we?
And we already are seeing a lot of suffering. And this winter, if it's a cold winter, we're going to see a lot of hardship because, you know, natural gas and home heating oil prices are forecast to be record highs this fall and this winter. And so it is very inefficient to rely on high prices alone to impact consumer and investor behavior. People are taking steps, they're driving less, they're burning less fossil fuels, but the fact is that American families are struggling under the sustained weight of these high prices, and that we need the government to spearhead investment in alternative energy infrastructure to give access to alternatives for working families, because they can't do this on their own. They need help desperately.
All right. Well, Tyson Slocum is the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He is a regular on this show called Flashpoints. And as always, we appreciate the very important, incisive, and good information, Tyson Slocum.
Well, Dennis, it was my pleasure.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Those who have studied the recent election steals of George W. Bush are gearing up for another electoral heist. On the forefront of trying to restrain the election stealers is Robert Bob Fitrakis. Fitrakis is an investigative reporter, the director of the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism, and a former Green Party candidate for the governor of Ohio. Most recently, Fitrakis wrote Article 28 and 29, I believe, of Dennis Kucinich's 35 Articles of Impeachment of the for the President of the United States. You heard Kucinich on here twice in the last very short time, first after the introduction of the 35 articles, and then most recently after the single introduction. But Bob Fitrakis, welcome to Flashpoints.
Oh, glad to be on.
Well, it's good to have you with us. You have done some pretty exceptional work trying to keep an eye on the election bandits. But first of all, tell us about Article 28 and 29. What are they? What do they say?
Well, basically, they date back to the 2004 election, and one deals essentially focusing on the activities in Ohio by Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell, and essentially argues he violated equal protection clauses of the Constitution and essentially systematically disenfranchised African-American voters. And it's a fairly airtight statistical case. For example, they purged 24.93% of every single voter in the city of Cleveland, which voted 81% for Kerry and was 51% black in the 2000 census. The other essentially draws in broader people into this, including Karl Rove and others, and notes that there was a subversion of the election process in Ohio, particularly in regards to statistically unlikely votes in 14 Republican counties, and also noting that there was an apparatus in place that essentially would allow you to electronically shift votes and steal an election.
Well, not only did Karl Rove avoid prosecution, but he's now a well-known commentator on Fox News, and he is his guidance continues to be a part of the commentary. What exactly did Karl Rove do that might have been prosecutable or a felony that could lead to an impeachment?
Well, what we're finding increasingly is under Karl Rove's direction, he did a variety of things. Number one, they sent a group he founded, and the members of it were glad to say they were founded by Karl Rove, the mighty Texas Strike Force, into Ohio. And then with the Secretary of State, J. Kenneth Blackwell, they essentially reshuffled all the precincts, then passed a directive that if you were voting out of your precinct, it wouldn't count, and then had anonymous sources calling people up and directing them to the wrong polling place. For example, I live here in the inner city on the Near East Side. I had a polling place that was about a half a block away on my street. They closed that. I was shifted to one more than half a mile away on a different street, but people were calling me up and telling me to go a tenth of a mile away across the street and about five houses down. So there was a systematic confusion at the direction of data miners working for Karl Rove. People also were, in fact, called up and given illegal and bad advice. I mean, they were intimidated from voting. Numerous calls, documented, numerous reports, sworn affidavit, that people were told, look, you're behind in your child support. You show up to vote, you'll be arrested. You're on probation. You show up to vote, we'll make sure you walk away in handcuffs. This was up-to-date material from the public records, and we used in a systematic way to target felons and particularly African Americans who are on probation and in halfway houses who had a right to vote under Ohio law and were threatened with arrest.
Wow. And what can you tell us in terms of on-the-ground testimonies and information that you were able to gather to confirm sort of at eye level how people were treated, discouraged, and undermined?
Well, you know, from the 04 election, it's, you know, they created these multiple districts and then they, you know, the machines went missing. When you conduct an election, you need 5,000 machines. You've only got 2,866. And then you leave 135 in the warehouse. And all the missing machines are concentrated in Columbus and 42 majority African-American wards and precincts are essentially missing machines. Their voter registration, in many cases, went up 25-30%, and they were taking away one in two machines. So an estimated 20% of the population in the inner-city African-American wards ended up with people, about 20% of them, walking away from the polls.
20% walking away without voting?
Yeah, we actually went through an entire precinct and got affidavits. People were very specific. They had waited for, you know, 2 hours in the morning. They had to go to work. They had to get their kids to school. They waited for an hour and a half at lunch. They waited, 3 hours at night. The admitted length of the wait in the inner city of Columbus in the majority African-American wards was between 3 to 7 hours.
And what was the percentage that they would vote Democrat versus Republican?
Well, you're talking about an area that on average was voting 87% for the Democratic Party candidate.
So you are convinced, you are sure, you are certain, how would you back this up, that the election that Ohio was tainted, undermined, and went for the wrong candidate?
Well, I would start with the exit polls. You know, when you have the exit polls, historically the gold standard of polling, saying that Kerry's winning 51-48, and the results are almost flipped. And you got to remember, at the same time a flip occurs, the official election results in Ohio were outsourced by the Secretary of State's office, right at the final close of polls and tabulations, to the old Pioneer Bank building in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The guy who built that apparatus down there, all these servers. So you're outsourcing the actual vote count, and then you're still getting all these central tabulators reporting to the Secretary of State. Essentially, you're running Ohio's official results through Mike Connell of SmartTech's servers. This is the same man who did GWB.com, GWB43.com, where Rove's missing emails from the White House are. So you've got the most partisan IT man in the world who sets up a parallel apparatus to run Ohio's official election results through. And the same man also brags about being the first private company to get his servers behind the firewall in the U.S. Congress. That's through another company, but it's the same guy, two different hats. It's called GovTech, and he has actually done the websites and has servers behind the firewall on the House Intelligence Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, the House Administration Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee.
Now, this is quite an amazing story, Bob Fotrekis. You write about this on your blog today, and you get into Mr. Mike Connell in some, and GovTech Solutions LLC in some depth. I want you to say a little bit more about the history of this guy and why you would be suspicious in terms of the role he's playing now, both in the Congress and in Ohio.
Well, number one, he's the single, you know, most well-known and partisan Republican IT operative in the United States. He goes...
Now, IT, what does IT mean? What does it
do? Well, information technology. He's the computer guru who created, you know, goes back to George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988, created the databases, the computer tracking networks, for the delegate counts in the 1988 election, which was initially close between Bush and Bob Dole. So he's got a long history of being involved in these computer operations. He really gets his big break in 1998 with Jeb Bush in Florida. But once he does these partisan websites, he then moves into the government apparatus and does a variety of computer work for the state of Florida. But then when he does the computers for Florida in 2000, Ohio in 2004, but after Bush wins in Florida in 2000, Jeb's brother, W wins, he ends up doing all this work for the U.S. Congress, and now he's working for McCain. So you've got essentially a huge apparatus, which we have an expert witness. We've filed suit regarding this 2004 case to ensure a fair election in 2008. But our expert witness, who has worked for the Pentagon, who's worked for the Secret Service, says, look, you've got an apparatus in place in Ohio that essentially can electronically steal elections. You've tied in real time all the county board of elections to the Secretary of State's office, and you allow them to essentially report their central tabulators, which we found in Ohio after 2004, don't match the actual then paper count, particularly on the punch cards. But all those punch cards are now gone. Almost all of it is going to be these electronic voting machines where there's no paper trail. You can't get in and look at a variety of things. I'll give you one quick example. In Miami County, they told us there was a 98.55% voter turnout in a precinct, South Concord. So after a year and a half of suing, threatening, we were allowed to get in. They told us that 679 out of 689 people voted in this Bush stronghold, where he's getting more than 70%. We went in and looked at the actual sign-in at the poll. There was only 547 people that signed in and voted.
No, that's not a good number there. Bob Fitrakis, all right, let's do a blueprint. What I'm getting from listening to you and listening to the extent of what appears to be some pretty profound fraud that led to the wrong person being elected, I assume that the infrastructure, as you suggest, is in place. Now, give us a blueprint. How will the next election be stolen?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's sort of like let us count the ways. Number one, I would argue it's already beginning to be stolen with purges, which are primarily done now electronically with databases at the county levels. And in Ohio, we even have a few counties that have outsourced to private companies like Diebold, or now it's known as Premier, that have direct ties through their top executives to the Republican Party. So the first thing they do is they shrink the electorate. Here's the question people need to ask. In a democracy, and particularly look at a state like Ohio, which the Republicans have to win the election, why would you be purging voters in a state that requires a picture ID and other forms of ID to vote? You know, minus a death notice, why would you be purging people, totally eliminating their names from the voting registration rolls? So that's the first thing they're going to do. And these voting rolls, these electronic voting rolls, as the Everest study pointed out in Ohio, are incredibly vulnerable, more vulnerable than the highly hackable push-and-pray touchscreen machines. So you've got these voting rolls at the county level where they're bringing every worker has access to them, and, you know, where you fill out a card, they sign up, they go online to register you to vote. But people can get in there and delete names. Remember, nearly 10,000 people were, quote, accidentally deleted, end quote, by Diebold in Cleveland right before the election in 2004. In three cities, primarily in the inner city, between 2001 and 2003, that is between the 2000 and 2004 election, they deleted 308,000 voters in Toledo, Cleveland, and the inner cities of Cincinnati. So that's how they begin to steal it. They begin to essentially eliminate people from the voter rolls. And then they go on from there for a variety of other things. If they need to, you know, they have an apparatus in place. The intimidation will begin to occur. The flyers will show up, misdirecting people and the callers to the wrong polling place. All of that will happen. Texts will come in with no background checks. And in Ohio, just today, it was announced that the highly hackable voting machines in the rural counties dominated by the Republicans, because they're rural and they don't have a lot of money and it's difficult, they're going to be allowed to sleep, have sleepovers with computerized programmable voting machines.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're speaking with Bob Fitrakis. He is clearly one of the experts who has been studying the way in which the U.S., United States elections, presidential elections, have been undermined, tainted, and stolen in recent years. And apparently, we cannot expect to have even close to a fair election. I guess that's what you're saying, Mr. Fitrakis, right?
Well, I'm saying is that you can have a relatively fair election, and we have the technology for it. It's pencil or pen and paper, which is used in 95% of the democracies in the world, including El Salvador, where I was an international election observer in 1994 after the Civil War, and where I essentially co-wrote and was the editor of the International Observer's Report. If I would have seen these things in El Salvador in 1994, my report to the world and to the United Nations would have been simply no way to verify, non-transparency.
So your advice to those of you, us who sort of still maybe believe a little bit in democracy? What do you think needs to be
done?
Well,
I think we've got to insist on transparency, right? You've got private for-profit corporations claiming that their source code is proprietary, programming the hardware and software on these machines. I don't see how you can have that in a democratic election. There's a couple of things you can do. You can have paper ballots. You can vote early. The worst of the machines options is to do a touchscreen with no paper. The best is probably an optical scan because you actually have a voter-verified paper ballot trail that can be recounted. That's how we found a lot of this fraud. And you need to post those results immediately at the precinct level before they go into these central tabulators, which really in Ohio and many states, the people that are servicing those tabulators, the Triad Company, they're the people that were involved in the butterfly ballot in Florida in 2000. They're with the Rapp family, a far right-wing, true believer family that spends most of its time, protesting at abortion clinics. And these are the people that actually go in before the election and set the county central tabulators.
Well, how could it be? And I guess the big question that people ask when they listen to a show like this is, if this fraud was so extensive, Mr. Fitrix, if all of this was really going on, how could it get by? How could they slip it by?
Well, first of all, they count on the socialization and enculturization of the American people. That is, that are reliant on six for-profit news sources that don't deal with this kind of stuff. I mean, here's the reality that Americans don't like to hear. This has been well established in the public record. Going back to the Church Commission, Senator Frank Church, in the mid-70s, where the CIA admitted to doing this stuff in the Third World, where they had rigged hundreds of elections. In fact, they had a term for it. It was called a benign operation, because it wasn't a bloody, vicious coup with tens of thousands of people dying or hundreds of thousands like in Indonesia. They had been rigging elections. They admitted to it. What happened is a lot of the software that began to be developed in the 1980s, and the first time we thought about this in terms of mainframe computers, 1980, the former CIA director, George W. Bush, ends up doing surprisingly well in Iowa when the mainframe computers freeze up. The conservative Manchester Union Guardian rightly suggests that it looked like a CIA operation in the Third World.
Okay, you know what? We're going to have to leave it right there. We are delighted to have this opportunity to talk with you, share amazing information that you have, Bob Fitrakis, former candidate for governor in the Green Party in Ohio, keeping an eye on the potential stealing of other U.S., more further upcoming U.S. elections. Mr. Fitrakis wrote Article 28 and 29 of Dennis Kucinich's 35 Articles of Impeachment. Thanks, sir, for being with us on Flashpoints.
All right. Glad to be on.
You're listening to POCC Block Report Radio and blockreportradio.com with Apollonia Jordan. Today, our guest is political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. During this interview, we will discuss issues involving the foster care system, gang injunctions, and the incarceration of young people. Hi, Mumia. This is Apollonia Jordan.
How are you, Apollonia Jordan?
I'm fine. I'm staff writer for the San Francisco Bayview newspaper.
I know who you are. I see your byline almost every week.
Thank you. I am so honored to be doing this interview with you today.
Thank you.
As you may know, I write a lot of stories that pertain to issues that
correctional institution at Green and is subject to monitoring and recording
that I've went through growing up, living in poverty in the hood and later being separated from my mom and sisters in the foster care system. And now I'm going through that same situation with my son. And how do you feel the foster care system and the criminal system is related, and how would you encourage young black mothers like myself to stay strong if they're going through the same issue?
Well, there is a relationship, and of course, both of them are united by the fact of poverty. I had that experience for several months in my youth. I was, you know, living in a foster home. And, you know, it was a loveless place. And, of course, I, you know, wanted to see my mother every day. She was ill, and so she couldn't take care of us. But both of them stem from poverty. And so both of them stem from how people are able to really subsist in this culture. If you are poor, I mean, there have been Supreme Court justices who've said as much. If you are poor in this country, then, of course, not only are you exposed to the indignity of a foster home and being separated from your family, but if you're poor in this country, you will not be able to afford decent legal talent, you see. And everybody knows that. You know, it's a matter of what you have, what you can afford, even when it comes to defending your life and liberty. It's no different if you're a poor family and you're broken up and, you know, children have to be separated.
Okay. Do you believe the struggle that youth of today are going through with, you know, dealing with death and poverty, police brutality and the criminal system are so, and so forth, is harder nowadays versus back when you hooked up with the Black Panthers at the age of 15?
In some ways, I think it is harder. And I'll say, I know while that may surprise many people, I think it is harder in this respect. Things were clearer back in the 60s and even in the 70s. In a sense, you knew who your enemy was, and that's because the United States and many states in the United States was more overtly racist. That has changed in some respects, so it's more difficult for a young person to really navigate. In many of the cities where there are large black populations, you may have black mayors, you might have black police chiefs, you might have a healthy number of black police officers. But, you know, in the real world, if you're poor, you're still dissed. You're still at the bottom of the barrel. And while it's true that that's true for white poor people and black poor people and brown poor people, it's accentuated, you know, in the urban centers in America because there are very few ways out. I mean, people look at drugs, the drug industry, I should say, as a way out, in many ways, the way out, the only way out. Or I read the article you did recently where a young brother was caught up in that and then he began putting his rap thing together. Well, you know, that's almost like doing the NBA. What we're looking at is deindustrialization that's happened in the last 30-something years, the export of jobs through globalization offshore, so that there are fewer jobs when you really have more people, because the population has really grown since 1970.
I don't know if you've heard a lot about this, but there has been a lot of gang injunctions going on in San Francisco and Oakland and in black communities around the world. I remember being back in high school where Proposition 26 passed, and it was that if there are three or more people and with the same color or the same clothing on, they could be classified as a gang. And now they have the gang injunctions where they're taking a lot of young black brothers and sisters out of their community, removing them so they can't go back into their communities or be around their families or be able to raise their children. And what are your beliefs on these gang injunctions and how they're using this to take away the black people's community?
Well, you know, again, this is a symptom of what can only be called white and state paranoia and an attack. You know, many people form gangs because that becomes their only family, because they are missing family at home, you know. And many times what police call a gang is not a gang. I mean, when, you know, black or Spanish guys are standing on the corner, it's a gang. When white guys are doing it, they're just hanging out in their neighborhood. Also, you have the situation where that is not just a California situation. There was a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court from Chicago, I believe, where something very similar was used against people in Chicago. Now, that was declared illegal, but they're doing it anyway. I mean, you know, because the state doesn't really abide by its laws. You know, you got secret prisons, you got torture, you got all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, they just look at that and laugh and do what they want to do anyway. You know, it's just another branch of the long continuing war against black poor people.
A lot of my friends have been caught up in the prison system. I've written articles about my best friend of mine who I grew up with, Jasmine, who got caught up when she was 18. She did 3 years in prison. She got out and was on parole and got caught up again, and now she's on her way to the federal penitentiary. How, and a lot of young people are going through this, are sitting down because they're not understanding, you know, their rights or understanding the criminal system itself. How would can you encourage them for young people who have to sit down and have to deal with that reality of being behind enemy lines and encourage them to cope with that life? Because it is a different life between inside and outside.
Well, I think it's better to do all we can to prevent it, you know, rather than dealing with it afterwards. And of course, you do have to deal with it afterwards. But, you know, there are examples through our history. And, you know, one of the most prescient and really revealing examples is that of Malcolm X. I mean, Malcolm, before he became Malcolm X, they used to call him Satan in prison. He was a hateful dude. But he became part of an organization that inspired him and really opened up the light in his mind. And he began seeing things from a different perspective. I mean, I give his background to illustrate that there are literally millions of young men who are potential Malcolms in every state prison, every federal prison in America. Because, you know, everyone has the capacity to learn, really, with very few exceptions. That's one of our human inheritances. But you have to be ready to learn. You have to be receptive to learn. You know, Malcolm got blessed to really have his mind open when he was ready. And there are many young brothers and sisters who have that opportunity now. You know, they need to just seize it and take it. And also another example, of course, is Nelson Mandela. You know, he was in one of the roughest prisons in South Africa. The brothers who were members of the ANC back then, they turned that prison into a university. So, you know, guys would be in there who were robbers and rapists and thugs and whatnot. When they came out, they were given such a good education.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
In the prison, that they came out as people who served their people, who became members of liberation movements and turned their lives around. We need to remember those lessons from history, sister.
Mia, I want to thank you so much for your knowledge, and I want you to know that my prayers are with you.
Thank you, sister.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. You're doing a hell of a job.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was an honor.
The honor is mine, sister. On the move. Give my love to everyone, okay?
Okay.
All right.
You are just listening to the voices of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal and myself, Apollonia Jordan, as we spoke about both our experiences with the foster care and criminal system on Black Report Radio and blackreportradio.com.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. And music breaks this week, Down the Line by Jose Gonzalez and Looking for a Leader by Neil Young. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.